I'm Steve Potter, and welcome to Cityscape. Pat Hazel was one of the original writers on Seinfeld. Tonight and tomorrow, he brings his one-man show, The Wonder Bread Years, to Washington University's Edison Theater. Pat Hazel, welcome to Cityscape.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be here.
And I'll admit it, I'm in the club. So what does it mean to be a baby boomer?
Well, you're in the club. What does it mean? You know, there's a specific period of time, I guess, and that is a post-war time, right? What are the years for the baby boomer?
Gee, wouldn't it be like early 50s to early 60s? Or?
Yeah, I am a coattail rider. I'm right at the end of it, right? I was born in 1961. But there is something about the era of when we had three televisions and maybe a UFH station or UFA.
Right.
You know what I mean? Where you had foil on the antennas and whatever, where we had a collective American consciousness. So partly what I use that baby boomer era for is a target to sort of reference all the nostalgia.
Well, and there are so many of us, so it's something that a lot of us can relate to, certainly, right?
Right. And, you know, I think with the advent of things like eBay, where you can suddenly call up your nostalgia, right? You just say, what did I have when I was a kid? Ooh, what condition would I like it in now? I'd finally have the money to buy it, right? So that, to me, was when I decided this sort of a show, this retro reflective show, had a real a gravity to bring people together.
Uh-huh. You call your show The Wonder Bread Years. I remember a time when I thought Wonder Bread was good.
Right. Well, it's surfed a wave up and down.
They still make that, don't they?
Yes, they do. But I think it's time. It is time why it was really supposed to be wonderful was, among other things, they pumped something in to keep it from drying out too fast, and they the preservatives and all of the helps build bodies strong ways, 12 strand ways. That was all promotional stuff, I think, to get us on board to a more preserved. But now we've gone through the 12 grain, you know, life. And
maybe that's the problem. Everything now has to be good for us. Back when you and I were young, it didn't.
No.
We could eat Wonder Bread, and we thought that was fine.
Right. We could ride on the back seat without us, sitting up on the ledge. Right. No seatbelt.
I rode on the dashboard
for
many years.
Right. We hung our heads out the window. We played with clackers and lawn jarts, and these were all death traps. But now every kid, you know, if you go to hug them, they got to have a helmet on, you know. Everything is super safety driven.
That'd be a good bumper sticker or something. I was a baby boomer and survived.
Right.
Hey, before we go into more of this, I have to ask you about, was it your big break? Do you call Seinfeld your big break?
Well, I would say it was a highlight. You know, there were chapters in my life. When I first did the Johnny Carson show, I was a kid from Nebraska who, doing stand-up and having started with magic and juggling and so forth, like to be on the Johnny Carson show and get his okay.
That's exactly how he started.
Well, it was awesome. Everybody in Nebraska said, when are you going to be on Johnny's show?
So, well, how'd that happen?
Well, it was an odd discovery. I mean, I moved from Nebraska to California, and I was working at some clubs and did some opening acts for various people. Somebody saw me, and they invited me to the show. And I kind of decided at that time I wanted to put the magic aside. I really wanted to be known for my sense of humor. But when I got invited there, Johnny invited me to his dressing room, like into his office, basically. He said, I heard you're good with a deck of cards. And, you know, I had this great, to me, my moment was off camera. We spent half hour, 45 minutes together, and somebody knocked on his door and said, John, we got a show to do here. And I thought everybody got to hang out with Johnny Carson. Very rare, I guess, you know,
yes.
Very private guy and so forth. But I showed him card tricks. He showed me coin tricks, and we talked about working at the same TV station in Omaha back in the day. I guess he was on a couple of, you know, chat shows or game shows or something like that. So it was a really interesting bond. And that, to me, was a big break in terms of the borrowed equity of Johnny saying, this guy's okay. So you walk out of the door with confidence. But the Seinfeld being tapped to be one of the original writers was a bit of a fluke in a way. My partner and I had written a play called Bunkbed Brothers, which we used as our sample script. And the two of us got the first two jobs with Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld, when at the time it was called the Seinfeld Chronicles, and they didn't know what time it was going to be on or if it was going to air. It was kind of under this late night and specials division. It wasn't even really a primetime slot. So at that time, I learned an accelerated learning curve from Jerry, particularly saying, we're going to write what entertains us. What's funny to us? Why start with one oar out of the water by being derivative of another show we've seen, or try to be like Murphy Brown or like other things that maybe were on the TV real estate at the time. So, you know, it was a sidecar of success, but you learn a lot from that.
I've got to ask you about the Seinfeld show. I can see that it would be challenging writing about something. But how do you write about nothing?
It couldn't be easier. I'll tell you what, it's very hard at the time for comedians to sit in a room that's fairly antiseptic, fluorescent lights, and go, now we're going to write something. But in those first several episodes when we had notions and stuff, they all came when we said, oh, let's go to lunch. We would walk out of the building, we'd go to lunch, all the walk from there to lunch, eating lunch. People would say things, Larry David would say, I don't feel confident in tan pants, and what are you going to do about the tuna sandwich, right? And the show, we would race back and write everything we talked about at lunch because we had a real hard time, I guess, working in an administrative fashion. But, I mean, everybody built discipline up from that. But I think the nothing is really about minutiae. It's about the observation of human behavior and that sort of thing.
Interesting thing about the Seinfeld show, I mean, some people really got it and other people didn't, which right. Yeah, I'm not saying that's a bad thing.
No, it's not. But I think what was the most telling, and I was long gone by the time they wrapped the show up, is they revealed one of their secrets near the end, which, you know, that was an anticlimactic closing to a big series. But one of the things they exposed was how tremendously selfish all of these characters, you know, particularly George and so forth, that they did everything for their own good and they would get, you know, hoisted on their own petard or whatever. And you kind of, it was a little bit of what I think was great about it was the narcissism of people who cared more about their friends than they did about their family and more about themselves than they did about other people. And in a way, it lives on in Larry David's writing on Curb Your Enthusiasm. You either like this guy or you really hate him. You know, when he takes a handicapped parking spot, you go, well, who does that? You know, he gets people worked up.
You know, I do listen to NPR. And just a few days ago, because I do, just a few days ago, they did a piece on Seinfeld just celebrated an anniversary. Was it 20 years or I don't know what my math is.
I don't remember. Yeah, it's easily 20.
Something like 20 years. So evidently you didn't observe that because you looked surprised.
I don't.
That was
I'm not
on your,
celebrating it. Yeah,
that's
it's
not
funny.
On your radar.
At the time that I wrote on the show, my philosophy was I can watch TV or write TV. I couldn't do both. So because people are like, oh, did you see this thing last night? I go, no, I'm too busy. I got to get this thing written. So, I mean, I think it's fantastic that it was of its time and that people came together for it and, you know.
Would you like to write on for another show or is that time passed?
No, I'm not sure that I'd like to be a mechanic in somebody else's shop as much.
Oh, you want your own show?
No, well, I did write a show that was very short-lived and didn't air called American Pie for NBC and I wrote 6 episodes and I had a really good time doing it. But I'm in the midst of writing other theatrical productions and so forth and I find writing original stuff is the network is, you know, much faster to grab onto a brand or a, you know, something they can hang their hat on to promote something.
And today, if it doesn't take off, something doesn't take off immediately, it's gone.
Immediately,
right?
Yeah. Even with the biggest name and the biggest amount of packaged items and theme songs, and it's the same with movies. They're recycling some old movie theme song just to make a Broadway musical out of, you know.
We're talking with comedian Pat Hazel, who's going to be appearing tonight and tomorrow at Washington University's Edison Theater. One more thing I wanted to ask you about Johnny Carson before we move on. I want to talk more about your Wonder Bread years thing. But you were talking about Carson, and with this whole shift in hosting The Tonight Show lately, there's been a lot in the press about that. And for maybe – I grew up with Carson, of course. In fact,
yeah.
That's why I'm in broadcasting, believe it or not.
He's the best.
But for younger people, he's probably just a distant memory. But anyway, over the last few weeks, there's been a lot about the private Carson and
right.
How, you know, his public persona was not – did not really reflect the private man that he really was. So I'm just curious about that. And since you spent some alone time with him.
Well, yeah. And again, it wasn't a lot of alone time. But I'd recently read the Johnny Carson book written by his lawyer. Mm-hmm. And I think he struggled with a lot. He struggled with a lot of things, right? So he saved it up. He was a private person, and he put out all that charm and all that wit
on
the air.
But he gave you some love.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't know if it, you know. I think it was something that interested him. He had several things. He played the drums, even at his own home. My understanding was he was happy behind the drum set. He would play tennis. He was happy on the tennis court. There were a lot of things that made the guy a melancholy guy that he tried to keep private, and I think was very successful for many years. But, you know, to hear about in these books talking about not having your own mom's approval or acceptance all your life at the top of your success,
that's
to not, yeah, that's
yeah.
A really must drive a person mad on the inside, right?
Yeah, you think
just
about that.
Built up anger, yeah.
Well, let's talk about the show you're going to be doing tonight and tomorrow night.
My built up anger will come out.
Okay.
Yes.
It's not going to happen this morning,
okay.
Is it?
No.
All right.
It might.
Just wanted to be sure. Now, you grew up in... you grew up as a baby boomer in Omaha, and I would think that wouldn't be a whole lot different than growing up as a baby boomer here in St. Louis.
Not at all. Yeah, I think we speak the same language. Now, the Midwest, the breadbasket has a certain, I can say pop here, and you know what I'm talking about, right?
Soda?
Is that what you call it in St. Louis?
Soda.
Oh, well, I'm going to have to translate. No, but there are parts of the country that you have to call it Coke, Orange Coke, or you have to do. So those are the only sort of places that are different, but a lot of times I'm talking about what I consider to be the strong common denominators of sitting at the kids' table and riding in the back of the country squire wagon and a trip to Dairy Queen. And when you tell that to somebody in New York, it is almost like you're in the movie Fargo. They think you're out of your mind. But here, people go, yeah, that's what we did.
Right.
That's how we did it.
In fact, to hear a couple of just random things from our generation, Kool-Aid. Manwich. Jiffy Pops, Twinkies, Spam. And on the record, Pat, I want to tell you, I remember when a fried Spam sandwich was pretty good.
Yeah. And you're not a military man.
No.
You're not Hawaiian.
I thought it was like a delicacy.
Right. Well, to me, any meal that is floating in a sea of gelatin that you need a skate key to get into, you know, that's a mysterious meal.
I might have one today just for old times.
Well, my dad told us that Spam stands for something posing as meat. That was his big.
So a little bit about your show. It's part like stand-up, maybe a little theater.
It's a hybrid. I'll tell you what I'm most proud of is that the storytelling and the stand-up are melded. There's an awful lot of jokes per square inch. But the memories are – I touch different touchstones. Some of it's with media, old film strips, family slides – and even some interaction with the audience, I asked them about show and tell items they brought. So that makes it different for me every time a little bit when they bring up somebody had a three-legged dog. Somebody found the other a week ago, somebody said, we found this dried up cocoon on the way to school. And we took it to school and we had it in a jar for 4 days. And then on the following Monday, we realized it wasn't a cocoon. It was a dried up dog turd. But the teacher, they had been monitoring and watching. Now, I don't think that guy has told the story since it happened. But there's a moment where the wife looks at him, what are you talking about, Bob? You know, they get kind of, it's a contagious ride. So they kind of bring out things that were just big moments for them.
Yeah, so your show sort of is an evolving thing as it goes on. You're getting new stuff from your audience every time you perform.
And my children right now. I used to be the kid that's making reflections of the dad that couldn't remember what he was talking about. I'm now that dad. So I repeat, my kids fought over chocolate. At Halloween, they were trading candy, and one says to the other, I hate dark chocolate. And the other one says, well, it's still candy. You got to respect that. You know, I don't write that. I just repeat it, right? I hear it and I think that's really what the Wonder Bread years is about. There's a safe time, I think, really before a certain period where your life is threatened in junior high or high school, where it is about curiosity, discovery, adventure, and abandon.
Well, I just want to acknowledge Charlie Robin, who's sitting off mic. He's the executive director of the Edison, and you've heard his laughing from time to time.
The left
so I just
track.
Want to do it. There he is. Hi, Charlie. How are you?
Ask him why he brought this show here. That's what I'd like to know.
So Charlie sits in the front row every performance, I guess, right?
You can hear him anywhere in the theater.
Edison Theater's Ovation Series presents Pat Hazel in the Wonder Bread Years. Charlie, since you're on mic now, anything you want to say about what people need to do ahead of time or tickets?
We have tickets available for both Friday and Saturday. You can call the Edison box office. You can go on the website. Any number of different ways to get tickets, just show up.
Or go to stlpublicradio.org to the Cityscape page. We'll have a link to all of that and much more. Both performances tonight and tomorrow at the Edison are at 8 p.m. We're talking with Pat Hazel, who is a writer, actor, comedian. And one final question for you. You know, you talked about you're a baby boomer. You're a dad now. You mentioned your kids a second ago, Pat. And here's what I want to know as an older guy myself. What don't these kids today get about us baby boomers? What don't they understand?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I think I'm not a curmudgeon. I'm not all about, oh, you shouldn't text, you shouldn't whatever. But I don't think they understand balance or focus or, you know, the fact that everything is now on a phone or in your hand, and you're always dialed down. I think we are a generation of people who look up and out, right? You look at this guy, you look at somebody. Everybody now is dialing into looking down, and it really, I think it's limiting. People aren't bored. We used to be bored a great deal of the time, right? They don't understand boredom. You literally now, I could walk in, stand in line at a DMV and go through all my email. I could somehow fill the time. But that used to be a time for thinking or imagination or dreaming or whatever. And I think that's a really interesting dilemma of today, which is not detaching occasionally. People are on cell phones on nature walks. It's sort of like, what's the point of mixing these two things together?
And I mean this sincerely. If I used social media when I was a kid like they do today, frankly, I wouldn't have a career.
I have trouble. I write with other writers, and I have to tell them we're detoxing until noon, right? Because they will text during the session, you know, and it's like, well, we're never going to write a song for this musical if we're busy writing other people. We've got to focus. So,
all right, Charlie Robin, stop tweeting now because the interview's over. Thanks for Charlie Robin for sitting over on the side. Pat Hazel tonight and tomorrow night at the Edison Theater. Thanks so much.
Come if you dare.
It's been great meeting you.
Thank you, Steve.
And next on Cityscape, comedian Greg Warren. This is St. Louis Public Radio.